You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in drone news, yes, drones are technology, we have to talk about taser drones. I think this is going to be a bad thing. Here's what's going on. This is coming from Engadget, but wow, this is nuts. Here's what's up. Axon, the drone maker, has paused work on a project to build drones equipped with its tasers. A majority of its artificial intelligence ethics board quit after the plan was announced about 2 weeks ago. Now, 9 of the 12 members said in a resignation letter that just a few weeks ago, the board voted 8-4 to recommend that Axon should not move forward with a pilot study for a taser-equipped drone concept. And I quote the resignation letter. In that limited conception, the taser-equipped drone was to be used only in situations in which it might avoid a police officer using a firearm, thereby potentially saving a life. They also noted that Axon might decline to follow the recommendation and were working on a report regarding measures the company should have in place were it to move forward. Now, the 9 individuals said they were blindsided by an announcement from the company, like I said, a couple weeks ago, and that was literally that announcement was 9 days after Uvalde, Texas, if you recall. Unfortunately and horrifically, 19 elementary school students and 2 teachers were killed by that monster, and they basically announced 9 days after that they were going to start development of this drone. Now, it had an aim of, quote, incapacitating an active shooter in less than 60 seconds. Axon also said, quote, Axon also said that it, quote, asked the board to re-engage and consider issuing further guidance and feedback on this capability. Axon CEO Rick Smith suggested that drones could be deployed as a measure to prevent mass shootings. As Reuters noted, he envisioned drones being stationed in school hallways and having the ability to enter rooms through vents. The drone system, which Axon suggested might be ready as soon as 2024, would cost the schools around $1,000 per year. I'm guessing that's $1,000 a drone. I'm not sure. Now, the camera system would have tapped into security camera feeds to detect active shooter events using both human monitoring and AI, or artificial intelligence. While the human operator would have made the final decision on whether to fire a taser, Axon planned to develop targeting algorithms to help with, quote, properly and safely aiming the device. And this seems like it's a little nuts in the sense that as you are looking at these things, obviously we are trying to come up with ways outside of gun control, because it doesn't seem like gun control is going to be passed, you know, in Congress or the Senate. And that's something I've written on in the wake of the Uvalde, Texas shooting. So we're trying to come up with things, but imagine the applications that a taser drone would have. I don't think this would live only in schools. If police forces could get a hold of these things for anything from riot control to just regular patrolling, I mean, we could see skies filled with drones, and everybody's looking at using drones, from Amazon to Walmart for deliveries, you know, military applications. I believe it's the Saudis, or, you know, maybe it's the UAE that has an entire fleet of drones. They've put on presentations with their military drones. I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely nuts. So anyway, Axon is halting this. I'd be curious to know if anybody thinks taser drones are a good idea, because I have a feeling they're going to be reality sooner than later. And so that is your drone news of the week. And I want to talk about mass shootings real quick. Obviously, in the last month or so, we've had some really horrific ones in Buffalo, New York, where I unfortunately watched that video as we track extremism. I watched his live helmet cam. It was horrible. I obviously didn't watch it live. I mean, I saw it in the aftermath of that. And then obviously Uvalde, Texas, which just is horrific with all those school children. But I want to talk about tracking potential mass shooters, because tracking them online is incredibly hard. Now, the preface here is that I recently published an article saying that we can leverage technology to help thwart mass shooters. And one of those items that's ramping up is artificial intelligence that the Facebooks and Twitters of the world are using, and the focus is on posts that could be potentially extremely mentally unhealthy. But outside of the privacy aspects of that on Facebook, et cetera, which I mentioned in my article, I also mentioned this caveat, and I'm going to quote my article directly. So this is me quoting me. However, It is worth noting that more fringe websites and smaller social media platforms that attract extremists will still continue to be an issue here. These types of terrorists want the largest audience possible to witness their point, so they tend to stream on the largest platform that they're at least remotely affiliated with. And with that, The Washington Post also released an article which bolsters my exact point, entitled, quote, "As young gunmen turn towards new social networks, old safeguards fail." And here's what's going on, you know, according to the Washington Post. Now, before two 18-year-old men allegedly killed 31 people in separate shootings over, you know, the past month, again, New York, Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, they turned to a variety of social media apps to share troubling private messages. Both men, one killed by authorities in Uvalde, Texas, and the other one has been charged in the Buffalo shooting, used a combination of the disappearing video app Snapchat, Instagram, direct messages, chat app Discord, and social app Yubo to meet people and share their violent plans with these acquaintances. In Buffalo, the suspect also used the video of basically the streaming platform Twitch to publicize his deadly attack. And that was horrific to watch. Just having watched that, that was absolutely horrific. Now, these apps, many of which have been adopted by Gen Z as teens and other young people seek out more private corners of the internet, they're ill-equipped to police this kind of content. They are fundamentally designed to keep communications private, presenting different challenges than Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, where violent screeds and videos have been algorithmically amplified to millions of viewers. The way that basically this generation is using social media more generally could render years of work to spot and identify public signs of upcoming violence as obsolete, and that obviously is a huge problem. Now, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said basically on the Wednesday in the aftermath of Uvalde that the Texas gunman wrote on social media that, quote, "I'm going to shoot my grandmother and I'm going to shoot an elementary school," shortly before the attack. Now, Facebook confirmed that the messages were sent privately, but declined to say which of its social networks were used. Stephen Garcia, who considers himself one of the Uvalde shooter's best friends in eighth grade, previously told the Washington Post that the shooter used the Yubo app, a platform where users can swipe on one another's profiles, kind of like Tinder, or hang out in live streaming rooms and virtually meet other users by playing games and chatting. In the Buffalo grocery store shooting, the alleged gunman sent an invitation to an online chat room on the instant messaging platform Discord that was accepted by 15 users, who were then allowed to scroll back through months of his voluminous writing and racial screeds and on and on and on. Users who clicked through that room could also view an online video stream, basically where footage of the Buffalo attack was broadcast. That attack was also broadcast on Twitch. Obviously, that's a live streaming platform popular among video game users. Twitch was able to remove the stream within 2 minutes of the shooting start, according to Angela Heschen, the company's head of trust and safety. The site has an all-hours escalation system in place to address urgent reports such as live stream violence. Those 15 people, though, were enough for his video to go totally viral outside of the mainstream platforms, and it's been seen millions of times by millions of people, including myself. That video goes on for about 6.5, less than 7 minutes, and it is just horrific. You see him driving around, you know, he has to turn around, he's trying to find this place, then he just gets basically pulls up right into the front and just starts shooting at everybody before he even walks into the building, and then he does. It's just horrific. Now, in the wake of the high-profile mass shootings in recent years, communities, school districts, and tech companies have made major investments in safety systems aimed at rooting out violent screeds in the hope of preventing attacks. The Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District, for example, uses an artificial intelligence-backed program to scan social media posts for potential threats years before the attack, although it's unclear whether it was in use at the time of that shooting. Those tools are ill-equipped, though, to address the surging popularity of live video streaming and private or disappearing messages that are increasingly being used by young adults and teens. Now, those messages are then closed off to outsiders who might be able to spot the warning signs that a troubled individual might be about to inflict harm upon themselves or others, meaning when you're in these isolated systems, these automated scanners, that you can buy from third parties simply cannot read these messages. And so they simply do not know, or they can't flag the warning areas. These newer social networks also have far less history of dealing with violent content, and they're less likely to have policies and personnel in place to respond to basically the incitement of violence on their services. That's obviously a huge issue. Now, the adoption of these upstart apps and mass shooting reflect a larger generational shift within social media use. Gen Z, teens, and young adults born after 1996 or so have been basically flocking to apps that emphasize private messaging and live streaming, or allow their users to post content that disappears from public profiles after a certain amount of time. That's what Snapchat was known for initially, is I could send you a image or whatever through Snapchat, and I could say, hey, burn this in 10 seconds a day, whatever it was. There you go. Snapchat obviously fined by the FTC for failing to live up to that promise, as they were storing all of that stuff on their servers in the cloud. But here we are. Now, on top of this, we have another fight on our hands in this realm, and that is encryption and privacy. Facebook and other companies have moved towards strong encryption technology, and that is basically technology that scrambles the contents of a message so that only the sender and receiver can see it. WhatsApp, Apple iMessage use it, as do messaging apps like Signal, although WhatsApp, to be fair, basically it is not as secure as they say. I can't speak for Apple's iMessage. Signal is pretty secure in that way. And Facebook has said that it plans to introduce encrypted messaging as a default setting into Instagram and Facebook Messenger, prompting backlashes from politicians and officials in law enforcement who have warned that broad adoption of this technology can leave them in the dark and make it more difficult to investigate violence. And so think about it, in that way, like it is absolutely like music. And hear me out. The evolution of social media is like the evolution of music. When you look at basically the origin of mass media, you know, when radio first came about, let's say through the 60s and 70s, you listen to what the radio stations would play, and, you know, record labels would pay for that. And so you would be listening to the big artists. But as the internet has exploded, so has diversity in music. And it's not like the diversity wasn't there. It's just that we weren't exposed to other cultures around the world. We weren't exposed to other musical styles. And therefore, the fusion of musical styles from around the globe into something new simply wasn't there. And that's what the internet has brought us. And with social media, you can think of, you know, the AOLs and the Prodigies and the CompuServes, you know, that gave us basic chat functions and basic rooms that we could go into, to chat with groups, all those kinds of things, you know, evolving into the Friendsters and the MySpaces, eventually into Facebook. And now we're moving back towards a more private, more isolated, more hidden kind of social media. And through this whole thing, we have to basically understand the concerns about privacy. You know, do we build laws that basically speak to the lowest common denominator in society, meaning we give up our privacy because, you know, we have a few bad apples in society? And do not get me wrong. Do not get me wrong. Do not get me wrong. This is absolutely horrific. We need to find a way to stop these kinds of shooters, but we have to balance the ability for, like, let's say, law enforcement to actually see what somebody is doing online versus the privacy that we should all have by default. I'm not planning on shooting up anything ever. And most of you that are listening to this, I would hope all of you that are listening to this are not planning on shooting up anything ever as well, minus maybe, I don't know, going to target practice. So do we have basically a choice here that says, do we give up privacy online to help track these shooters, or do we do something else that ensures our privacy but also helps catch this, whether that's mental health background checks before you get a gun, some kind of gun control? I'm not adjudicating that. There are very strong opinions on that. I wrote an article basically on that for smirconish.com that you can go read. It was one of my latest published articles. I don't think it's my newest, but it's one of my newest. And you can go read my thoughts on that. But this is a huge problem. We have to figure this out. But at the same token, law-abiding citizens should also not have to give up their privacy. And so I think this is going to be one for the ages. But that is your, you know, interesting, unfortunately, school shooting news of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in voting news, and unfortunately we do have to talk about voting news, voting software is vulnerable in at least 16 states. Now, I'm going to cue the hate mail here already for this, that I'm going to get over this one, but this is absolutely important. And unfortunately, we have to talk about this, but we really, really do, because this falls in the realm of cybersecurity. Now, this is coming from the Associated Press, and here's what's going on. Electronic voting machines from a leading vendor used in at least 16 states have software vulnerabilities that leave them susceptible to hacking if unaddressed. Basically, the nation's leading cybersecurity agency sent out an advisory on this to state election officials. Now, the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, or CISA, said that there is no evidence that flaws in the Dominion voting system equipment have been exploited to alter election results. I'm going to say that again. There is no evidence the flaws in Dominion voting systems equipment that we're talking about here have been exploited to alter election results. I was all over this in the 2020 election, the 2016 election as well. We know that there are flaws, but think about it this way. You can park your car outside and leave your doors unlocked overnight. That doesn't mean somebody opened a car door and got into your car and did whatever they are. I have seen zero evidence. You are talking to a person who sat through 3 days of the MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell's cyber symposium, who he claimed he had, where he claimed he had evidence, and I saw zero, none. I'd love to see it. I want to see it. Objectively, I'd want to review it to make sure that what I'm seeing is what I'm seeing. I'm happy to change my tune, but 60 plus court battles, a lot of them thrown out procedurally because there was no chain of evidence, no chain of custody for the evidence, basically really underscores we have zero evidence whatsoever that anything was tampered with. I can leave my car unlocked. It doesn't mean somebody broke into it or opened the door. Now, this advisory is based on the testing by a prominent computer scientist and expert witness in a long-running lawsuit that is unrelated to the false allegations of a stolen election pushed by former President Trump after his 2020 election loss. This is going to get me hate mail, but I have seen zero evidence of that. Now, the advisory obtained by the Associated Press in advance of its release, it's obviously out now, details 9 vulnerabilities and suggests protective measures to prevent or detect their exploitation. Amid a swirl of misinformation and disinformation about the elections, CISA seems to be trying to walk a line between not alarming the public and stressing the need for election officials to take action. CISA's executive director, Brandon Wales, said in a statement, quote, that states basically, CISA executive director Brandon Wells said in a statement that states' standard election security procedures would detect exploitation of these vulnerabilities in many cases and would prevent attempts entirely, meaning we have what's called UTM or Unified Threat Management firewalls that are sitting in basically in front of the internet. So as anything is coming in and out of these networks, they are being detected for threat. But most voting machines are offline. Most voting machines do not touch the internet. You'd have to physically tamper with something, and that is a Herculean lift. I actually wrote an article about that in the wake of the 2016 election for a previous publisher that went viral. That was one of my most read articles. It is so unbelievably hard to tamper with an election. Yet, the advisory seems to suggest that states aren't doing enough. It urges prompt mitigation measures, including both continued and enhanced, quote, defensive measures to reduce the risk of exploitation of these vulnerabilities, end quote. Now, those measures need to be applied ahead of every election, obviously, and it's clear that that's not happening in all of the states that use these machines. Now, the University of Michigan computer scientist J. Alex Halderman, who wrote this report on which the advisory is based, has long argued that using digital technology to record votes is dangerous because computers are inherently vulnerable to hacking and thus require multiple safeguards that aren't uniformly followed. He and many other election security experts, myself included, have insisted that paper ballots, hand-marked paper ballots, is the most secure method for voting and the only option that allows meaningful post-election audits. Yes, 100% yes. I am all for getting rid of all voting machines and moving back to paper ballots. It's a pain in the butt, but there are guarantees there. Quote, these vulnerabilities, for the most part, are not ones that could be easily exploited by somebody who walks off the street, but they are things we should worry about, or we should worry could be exploited by sophisticated attackers, such as hostile nation states or by election insiders, and they would carry very serious consequences. That is according to Halderman. Now, the potential for meddling by election insiders actually had been illustrated by Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters in Colorado, who basically had become a hero to the election conspiracy theorists. I actually watched her at Mike Lindell's Cyber Symposium live. I was live streaming it, watching the whole thing. When it basically was announced that there were warrants out for her arrest, she was a huge Mike Lindell supporter, huge, Big Lie supporter as well. And so basically, here's what happened. Data from the county's voting machines appeared on election conspiracy websites last summer, shortly after Ms. Peters appeared at the symposium with Mike Lindell. She had been indicted and was recently barred from running for Secretary of State. Halderman found that an attacker with physical or network access could gain control of the voting machine and install malicious code that could alter results. These include accessing the election management system to modify files before they're uploaded to voting machines, or forging cards that were used by technicians, voters, and poll workers to gain unauthorized access to machines. Now, this is something that obviously is a concern. This is what happened essentially to SolarWinds, that massive hack at the end of the Trump presidency, beginning of Biden's presidency, where SolarWinds basically got hit and essentially a fake certificate was created by Russian hackers. And all of these companies had no idea that their SolarWinds was infected, and they were updating them with these malicious updates. That's essentially what they're talking about here. Now, Halderman is an expert witness for the plaintiffs in a lawsuit originally filed in 2017 that targeted the outdated voting machines that Georgia was using at that time. Now, the state bought the Dominion system in 2019, but the plaintiffs contend that the new system is also insecure. A 25,000-word report detailing Halderman's findings was filed under seal in federal court in Atlanta last July. Obviously, you don't want that to get out because you don't want to give a roadmap on how to break into something that is insecure publicly. That's why that's under seal. I guarantee you that's why. Now, U.S. District Judge, Amy Totenberg, who's been overseeing this case, has expressed concern about releasing the report, worrying about the potential for hacking and misuse of that sensitive election system information. As I just said, she agreed in February that the report could be shared with CISA, which promised to work with Halderman and Dominion to analyze the vulnerabilities and then help jurisdictions that use those machines to test and apply any updates to protect them. Halderman agrees that there's no evidence the vulnerabilities were exploited in the 2020 election. Again, the guy deeply looking into this agrees that there is no evidence the vulnerabilities were exploited in 2020. Now, that wasn't his mission, and he admits that. He was looking for ways that Dominion's Democracy Suite ImageCast X voting system could be compromised. The touchscreen voting machines can be configured as ballot marking devices that produce a paper ballot or record votes electronically. Halderman said it's, quote, an unfortunate coincidence, end quote, that the first vulnerabilities in polling place equipment reported to CISA were basically Dominion machines. Quote, there are systemic problems with the way election equipment is developed, tested, and certified, and I think it's more likely than not that serious problems would be found in equipment from other vendors if they were subjected to the same kind of testing, and that's according to Halderman. On a complete aside from that, there is another voting system called ESNS. I remember talking about this on my radio show years ago, that basically did have vulnerabilities that they knew about as well. ESNS is another large maker of electronic voting machines as well. So it's not just Dominion, for the record. Any computer, even Microsoft Windows, has vulnerabilities. That's why you patch it every month. Now, the CISA advisory specifically advises using against the machines as they are configured in Georgia, where a printed paper ballot includes both a bar code and a human readable list reflecting the voter's selections, and votes are tallied by a scanner that reads the barcodes. So, Quote, when barcodes are used to tabulate votes, they may be subject to attacks exploiting the listed vulnerabilities, such that the barcode is inconsistent with the human readable portion of the paper ballot. Meaning, let's say you voted for, I don't know, Trump or Biden or whoever in 2020, your barcode says the opposite. You voted for Trump, the barcode says Biden. You voted for Biden, the barcode says Trump. Now, CISA is recommending that the voting machine should be configured, if possible, to produce, and I quote, traditional full-face ballots, end quote, rather than the summary ballot that has the barcode, meaning you essentially get a receipt that says everybody you voted for, it's clearly legible, it's got a unique ID on it that can be tracked back to the system, et cetera, et cetera. If you're going to use electronic, that's the way to go. Now, the affected machines are used in at least by at least some voters in at least 16 states, and in most of those places, they are only used for people who can't physically fill out a paper ballot by hand, according to voting equipment tracker maintained by the watchdog Verified Voting, meaning even though these places, these voting machines are there, most people are still not using them. But though, in some states, including Georgia, almost all in-person voting is done on these machines. Now, Georgia's Deputy Secretary of State, Gabriel Sterling, said that the CISA advisory in a separate report commissioned by Dominion recognized that, quote, existing procedural safeguards may make it extremely unlikely that a bad actor could exploit the vulnerabilities identified by Halderman. He called Halderman's claims exaggerated. Now, Dominion has also told the CISA that the vulnerabilities have been addressed in subsequent software versions, and the advisory says election officials should contact the company to determine which updates are needed. Halderman tested machines used in Georgia and said it's not clear whether the machines running other versions of the software share the same vulnerabilities. Halderman also said that as far as he knows, quote, no one but Dominion has had the opportunity to test their asserted fixes, end quote, meaning nobody malicious has been able to test and see if they can exploit this. Dominion has been the only one. Now, to prevent or detect the exploitation of these vulnerabilities, the advisory recommendations include ensuring voting machines are secure and protected at all times, conducting rigorous pre- and post-election testing on the machines, as well as post-election audits, and encouraging voters to verify the human readable portion on the printed ballots.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff, and I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.